Let's take our Bibles, go to 1 Peter chapter 3, if you would, please. We're going to look at verses 8 down through 22. We'll finish out the chapter 3. We did kind of a whirlwind overview of it last week, a little bit longer passage, but let me just review real quick what arguments the author has given to us. He says in chapter 2, verse 9, "You are this. You're a chosen race. You're a royal priesthood. You are a holy nation. You are a people for His possession. And you've been built, you've been designed to proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you did not receive mercy, but now you have received mercy. But this mercy comes with a price. You've been bought with a price, but you've also been designed for a purpose, to speak the excellencies of your God." And so he says down in verse 11, "As sojourners and exiles, abstain from the passions, but live honorably. Abstain from the passions of the flesh, which are waging war against your soul. But live honorably among the Gentiles." What does that look like? It looks like honoring everyone, verse 17, "as citizens in this world," including the emperor, by the way, who's kicked you out of where you've lived and who's put you as sojourners and exiles in a place far away. It looks like being, verse 19, "servants who are subject to your masters, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust." It looks like wives who are subject to their husbands, who are not necessarily believing husbands who are disobedient to the word. It also means being husbands who recognize and understand where your wives are and calling them to join you in this pursuit of faith. And so he calls us to enter into the proclaiming the excellencies of our God in the midst of a world that doesn't look like our expectations, in a world that's broken, in a world that's filled with injustice. Proclaiming the beauties of Him who's called us to reflect those beauties. And then He gives to us, right at the end of chapter 2, what does that look like? It looks like Jesus, who took our sins in His body, nailing them to a tree so that we can live unto righteousness, being healed by His stripes. Jesus enduring suffering for our salvation. Strangely enough, that's exactly what He's calling us to do as well. As we endure suffering, we become the means of God's blessing to others, whereby they enter into God's salvation. And that's what it means to proclaim the excellencies of Him. That's why we can never afford to not bless our God in the circumstances, because not just is our obedience dependent on our reaction, but also how others access our God through our reaction to the circumstances that God puts us in life. He's just talked to husbands and wives in chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. Now verse 8, "Finally, all of you," that's a pretty broad stroke, "finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. For whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the Spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah. While the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through water. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you, not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, with angels, authorities, and powers having been subjected to him. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Psalm 34, verse 8 says, we've read it. We've looked at that this morning. We've talked about that. The psalmist then goes on to explain what happens if we do. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Blessed has the idea of happy, of a life that's ordered well, of ordered right. It's the of life. Blessed is the man who rests in God, because God is good, and you can taste it and you can see it. In other words, God's goodness brings blessing to those who trusts him. That's what the Bible tells us. Now, let me take you to this week. As I was working through emails earlier this week, I came to a blog, Tim Challies, you're probably aware of the name. His son was down at Boyce College, down by Southern Seminary, down in Kentucky. And I opened the blog, and it says, my son, my dear son, has gone to be with the Lord. I thought, oh, that's going to be an interesting blog. I didn't realize that he was talking about his 20-year-old son who collapsed this week, playing on a basketball court with his daughter, who's down there at college with him, and a couple friends, and he collapsed, and they did CPR, and nothing could bring him back to life. A 20-year-old boy entered into eternity. I sat back in my chair and I wept, because I happen to have a girl down at college and a boy who's down at college. I thought, God, why his son and why not mine? What's happening? And obviously many were praying for him and responding beautifully in the midst of all this, confessing the confusion, but praising God in the midst of his struggle. When on Facebook yesterday, my wife found out that the youngest son of the Stodolas is no longer on this earth. He's with God in heaven. The last son at home. The others all moved away. Child gone to be with the Lord. Wait a minute. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who places his trust in him. Good, huh? Good. We can go to the elections this week. And whether your guy won or not, you can look at the brokenness of the system. You can look at all the different theories and things that are going on. Votes added, votes subtracted, different machines functioning, different counters allowed in or not allowed in. You can look at the factionalism of our country and you say, this is ugly. This is broken. This isn't what I expected. This isn't where I wanted us to go. Disappointment. Taste and see, the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who placed their trust in him. Okay, this is what good tastes like. This is what good looks like. Thank you. And yet, this is exactly what God is doing. Laura reminded us, his ways are perfect. Perfect. So as Christians who are seeking to trust God, how do we square these events with the blessing that God promises in Scripture? Peter writes a book to remind his readers of the fact that all who trust in God realize that in this broken world, God uses the real brokenness of this life to reveal the bright reality beyond this life. We know that this isn't it. We know that whatever page we're on in this story, there's another page. That whole gospel song, we've read the back of the book and we win, right? That's not just a corny song. It's a reality. We've read the back of the book. God is moving this story in a certain direction, and it can't be complete until Jesus wins, until Jesus is glorified, till every knee shall bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is higher than the president. Jesus Christ is
Lord. That's where the story goes. And until we get there, we're not at the end of the story. And so we know we're simply in the middle of it. Peter writes this book to remind his readers of a fact that all who trust God realize that in this broken world, God uses the brokenness to speak of a reality beyond this life. Joseph knew that. Remember at the end of the book of Genesis, he says, "You meant it for evil, but God what? Meant it for good." This wasn't outside of God's control. God had a purpose for this brokenness. David knew it. As Shimei is throwing stones and cursing him as he's running away from a son who's coming to steal the throne, his general wants to run him through on the end of a spear, and David says, "Leave him alone. It may be that God has told him to curse me." Paul knew it. He returns to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch, and he strengthens the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith and saying that through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of heaven. We don't get there without the trials, without the troubles. The writers of Hebrews knew it. He says in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10, "It's fitting that he for whom and by whom all things exist," that is Jesus, "in bringing many sons to glory should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source," and the idea is of perfection. We don't get made perfect except through the process of suffering. Suffering means hurt. Suffering means pain. Suffering means circumstances that don't line up with your happy place in life for sometimes long periods of time. But even Jesus didn't get the glory without the suffering. That's why Peter writes to these exiles to encourage them and to remind them that God does his best work with broken. And even in their troubling circumstances, he's not finished working. That's why Peter issues a call to all who would desire to follow Jesus. He says, "Let your life be an instrument to proclaim God's goodness." He said it way back in chapter 2, verse 9. "You're a chosen people, you're a holy nation, you're a royal priesthood, who've been called out to proclaim the excellencies, the absolute magnificence of your God, the absolute uncompromising goodness of your God in a world that is broken." You are, if you don't sound these notes, who will? If you don't sound these notes, who will? But you know what God gives you in order to play the music of heaven? He gives you the circumstances that don't line up with what you call good just yet. He says, "Here's your score." You look at it, you say, "Wait a minute, how do I make music of this?" And the answer is you can't, except that you have His Spirit living inside of you, who's transforming not only you, but the circumstances in your life to bring Him glory. It's a very simple question today. Will you let God use that thing in your life that you want to ditch, that you've been praying for Him to take away, that you've rebelled against, that you've complained about? Will you let God use that to bring Him praise through you? That's the question. We're going to look at this morning because there's two ways that suffering enables us to proclaim God's goodness. The first is this: suffering enables the believer to be a mouthpiece of God's blessing. He gives us first an explanation of what he means by this in verses 8 and 9. He says, "Finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless, for to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing." He gives us a little bit of an idea what he's talking about here. He tells us we're supposed to have something. "Finally, all of you have," and that verb isn't there in the text. It's kind of presumed. "Having these things," he's going to move on for having these things, verse 9, don't repay evil, but on the contrary, bless. But what are the things we're supposed to have in place in order for this to work? Well, he gives us five virtues, which really correspond to the five passions that we're called to abstain from back in chapter 2, verse 1. I'm going to ask you to go there again. Chapter 2, verse 1. So put away malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and slander. Malice and slander are others-oriented. Malice is hating others. Slander is hurting others. So he kind of bookends these passions were to abstain, remembering that these are exiles. These are people who don't fit where they're placed. They're the ones who are receiving slander. They're the ones who are being reviled. They're the ones who are being pushed out to the edges. They're the ones who don't fit. He says, in the middle of your not fitting in this culture, I want you not to hate others and I want you not to hurt others. Well, how can I do that? Well, the middle three passions are all self-focused. Don't be filled up with deceit. That is, don't be filled up with looking for opportunities for self-preservation. Bending, manipulating truth in order to be safe. Secondly, don't be filled up with hypocrisy. That is, don't be looking for opportunities for self-promotion. Don't put on a mask to make others think that you're better than what you are. And thirdly, he says, don't be filled with envy. That is, don't be filled up with self-pity. Don't be looking at what others had and feel sorry for yourself. If only I had that child, then I could, if I only had that spouse, if I only had that car, if I only had that job. You ever think like that? If I only had, well, then I could be something, but since I don't have those opportunities. And the focus is on self. And so he says, you got to put these things off. You got to put off a bad attitude toward others and a desire to hurt others because you're looking at yourself. Get your eyes off yourself. Now he comes up here in chapter 3, verse 8, and he says, now you've put those things off. Now put these things on. I'm presuming that you have these articles or these vestments at your disposal. And he gives, again, five virtues, and on both ends he's going to sandwich them with a word that talks about your mind. He says in the first part there, verse 8, he says, finally, all of you have unity of mind. And the last one he says, have humbleness of mind. He's talking about their mind. If you're going to do this, you've got to put off these passions and you've got to be filled up with intellect. Go back to chapter 1 again, verse 14. Well, actually, go back to verse 13. Therefore, preparing your minds for action, and we talked about that's literally to gird up the loins of your mind. Don't be tripped up in your mind. Be sober-minded. As obedient children, verse 14, don't be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, of your former low-mindedness, stupid-mindedness, unthinkingness. Don't just react to the world around you, but put on a mind that is able to process events, circumstances, and reality. What's the reality behind this reality? Is there something more to this than just what I see? And the answer is yes. God stands behind this reality. And so he says in chapter 3, verse 8, put on, have these things at your disposal, the unity of mind and a humbleness of mind. You have to remember that what Satan's doing in the middle of this brokenness is he's trying to isolate you. He's trying to make you feel like you're the only one in this battle. Like everyone's abandoned you and you've been left behind. And this is worthless, this is pointless, this is futile because you're the only one left on the battlefield. You feel like Elijah, I'm the only one left. And God looks down lovingly and says, my son, there's 7,000 who haven't bent the knee. You're not the only one. You're in this with others. When I feel like I'm alone, I was talking to a guy this week. He's working through some things, getting his eyes on Jesus, and he said, you know, I'm really disappointed with believers in my life. They didn't come through with me. They didn't call me. They didn't care about me. They didn't. Let it go on for just a little bit, and I said, now, wait a minute. Did it ever occur to you that some of those people also might have been going through some difficult times? Which one of them did you reach out to? Well, they didn't do it for me. I was, right. But they were hurting at the same time that you were hurting. And so while they didn't reach out to you, were you reaching out to them? No. And so he says, listen, if we're going to do this well, if we're going to be the voice piece of God's blessing, we've got to have a mind that connects us to others. We've got to realize that I've got my pains, but other people have their pains as well. I've got to support them. I've got to come around them. And he says in Galatians, let those who are strong take up the burdens of those who are weak. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Have this unity of mind. You are connected to others in this battle. But Satan's trying to divide you. Satan's trying to push you out. That's this coronavirus, I think, Caressa, you said, drives me crazy. Why? Because it isolates us. It makes us live life alone, which is exactly what the enemy wants of us. And it's not what we're designed for. We're designed for together. Not only have this unity of mind, but a humbleness of mind. A mind that is willing to put myself under. Are you okay with God using you? Or do you want to write yourself in as God of your life, as author of your own play, as the creator of your own story, of your own destiny, of your own identity? Or are you willing to be a part of a bigger story than your own? If you don't have that humility, if you've got to be the star, you're always, always, always going to be disappointed, because nobody thinks you're the star of the story. Nobody except you. But if you've got a humble mind, you're going to realize that my part fits into something bigger. And so he says, have this unity of mind, have this humbleness of mind. And in between, he's going to talk about not just mind, he's going to talk about feelings. Sympathy. Feeling alongside. One person calls this fellow feelings. I love that. Learn to put on feelings that engages with the feelings of others. Can you feel when somebody else is hurting? Can you feel when someone else is excited? Can you rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep? If not, you don't have sympathy along with pathos, that fellow feeling. He says, also put on brotherly love. Put on that kinship affection, that home for the holidays kind of love. I want to be with these people. When you think about Sunday, do you think, wow, I get to be with these people, my people, the people that think like me, the people that we get excited about? Or is it like, oh, Sunday, I got to go back, those people. Or is it those people? Put on this brotherly affection. And then he says, put on a tender heart. And literally here, it's the word good guts. Splunkna. It's the idea of what's inside just kind of spilling out. It's the word compassion. He says, when you see others in their hurtingness, does it even make you react? Do you want to help? Or are you reviled by that and say, oh, that's a needy person. You go over there. I'm going to go with these other people who have it all together. Have you ever thought like that? Oh, come on, you have to, right? Oh, not today. I don't have that much to invest. You thought like that? He says, you know what? Good guts. I want you to feel their pain. I want you to come alongside. I want you to, like Jesus, he's going away for a holiday. He's trying to get away with the disciples. And he's got the multitude chasing after him. And he looks on them and he says, oh, they're like sheep having no shepherd. And the guys are like, Jesus, about that holiday. Jesus says, you know what? They have a need. And he turns towards them. We're not going to have that until we realize that this is what God has for us. God has a sympathy for us. God has a brotherly affection for us. That verse we stopped a little bit in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 11. It says, because we both have the same means of perfection, suffering, I'm not ashamed to call them brothers. Jesus says that about you. And so there's no way that I can showcase God's goodness unless I enter into God's goodness. And that's why he says at the end of verse 9, don't repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless, because to this you were called, so that you can obtain a blessing. We're called for a very high purpose, to bless those who curse us. Luke chapter 6. Jesus says, this is what I want you to do. Those who curse you, those who revile you, I want you to bless them. I want you to pray for them. I want you to love them. You what? How can I do that? I've called you to be a blessing, but I've not called you to be a sponge that never gets filled. I am pouring blessing into your life so that you can be a blessing. Go back to Genesis chapter 12. We sometimes miss this. When we talk about election, it's an old doctrine in the scriptures. God chose Abraham. When we talk about election, we sometimes think of exclusiveness. But when God talks about election, he talks about inclusiveness. God says, Abraham, you know why I chose you? Verse 2, I will make of you a great nation, I will bless you and make your name great, so that what? So that you will be a blessing. When God chooses somebody, he chooses them to use them, to draw others into this story, to make them a part of his story, to help them to see God's goodness, to taste God's goodness, to sing God's goodness, to rejoice in God's goodness. Whoever God chooses, he uses to bring others into this story. And so he says, Abraham, I'm going to make you such a blessing that one day every family on earth will be blessed through you, through Jesus Christ. And so he says, listen, don't revile, don't give them evil, give them blessing. But the only way you can do that is by being filled up with blessing. You've got to take that tanker, once it's been emptied, you got to go back, you got to fill it back up again, so that when you can get out on the scene, you're ready to pour it out. And so that's what he's calling us to. And he gives us this what not to do. Don't repay evil for evil, but instead bless, because you've been called to this and you will receive a blessing. Now, he gives us not only an explanation of what we're supposed to do, but he gives us an example. He's going to quote from Psalm chapter 34. He's going to use a psalm where David is in exile. Now remember, he's writing to exiles. He's writing to strangers. He's writing to people who don't fit there in Asia Minor. They've been transplants. And he says, you're not the first people in the world who don't fit where you're at. There's been others before you. And David, writing from exile, writes, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise will be continually in my mouth. And as he works through what God has called him to do, we prayed through it this morning in our time of prayer, but the first three verses, he uses five different words, how our mouths are supposed to be active in singing God's praise and proclaiming his goodness. He says, I will bless the Lord. That's to take note of his glories and respond in adoration. His praise will be in my mouth. That's to extol the virtues of somebody. He says, I will make my boast in the Lord. That's to express joyful confidence in this God. He says, oh, magnify this God with me. That's to cause him to look as big as he is. I can't magnify God as in God's big. I can't make God bigger. I can't make him bigger. But I can make God look as big as he is to those who are watching. But here's probably the flip side of it. I can actually make my God look small. When I come up to those pressures in life, when I come up to those sufferings in life, when I stub my toe and I utter the curse word, I just make my God look small. God, why did you give this to me? Why are you doing this to me? Don't you know? Don't you? I'm making my God look small. How do I make my God look large? You know what, God, I don't understand why you took my son. But you've given and you've taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I didn't make God bigger. Job didn't make God bigger at that moment. But he magnified God to those who were watching God through his life. You can't do this on your own. This is a God thing. It requires a God power. It requires his spirit as the engine house of your life, producing something in you that looks like new life, because you don't have this by yourself. And then he says at the end of verse 3, let us exalt his name together. That's to lift him up, to raise him above, kind of like a standard in the midst of the fight. Remember the name of our God. This is why we're doing what we're doing. Let's exalt his name. Let's lift his holiness high, so that in the midst of the battle, we can remember who we are and why we're fighting this fight. So this is the psalm that he's going to quote from, verse 10. I want you to obtain a blessing, because remember this, whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him do this. Well, it's interesting what he picks up on. Let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. What? He focuses on what I'm saying? How I'm responding with my mouth? What does God care about that? God cares everything about that. Because chapter 2, verse 9, you've been called to show forth the excellencies, to proclaim the excellencies of God. And if I'm speaking ugly with my mouth, how is anybody going to see the beauty of my God? And so he says, listen, you've got to bless, because there's a lot dependent on this. If you would see good days, if you would know the blessing of God in your life, you must hold back your tongue from evil. You must hold back your tongue from deceit. You must turn away from evil and do good. You must seek peace and pursue it. People aren't the problem. Sin is the problem. And so Jesus came and took the sin so that he could save the people. And he said, that's what you're called to do. And God is using the events in your life to draw others in. Now, they're going to respond to you with the ugliness of their sin. But the people are not the problem. And if they can see God in your life in such a way that they actually see who he is, they can taste his goodness because they see you tasting his goodness. Wow, what an opportunity you've been given. And it's actually the suffering that enables me to become this mouthpiece of God's blessing. There's a danger in all of this, that I wouldn't actually receive the blessing of God. That I wouldn't actually receive the power of God to accomplish my purpose. Look what he says here. Verse 12, for the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, his ears are open to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now he's writing to believers. But he's saying, bless so that you may obtain a blessing. But there's a danger that you might not obtain a blessing. If you don't enter into tasting God's goodness, you will not have the power to proclaim God's goodness. If you do not rejoice in God's goodness to you, nobody else will see God's goodness through you. It's impossible. You yourself become the bottleneck. You yourself become the cork. You stop up God's blessing in your life. Not that you lose his salvation, not that you lose his spirit. It's just that his spirit is inoperative. You've lost that ability to showcase because you've entered into complaining, reviling, cursing, passions, rather than rising up above with thoughtful intentionality of fulfilling your purpose of blessing God and blessing others in the midst of your circumstances. Now he's going to call us to a second, give us a little bit of an explanation of the second thing we're called to do. Suffering enables us to be a mouthpiece of God's blessing, but suffering enables us then to be a mouthpiece of God's ways. And he's going to give us, again, an explanation and then an example. An explanation in verses 13 through 17. He says that suffering for doing good is not normal. Verse 13. Now, who is there to harm you if you're zealous for what is good? He's writing before Nero is focusing on Christians. But he's kind of making a general statement. Suffering for doing good is not the normal way of life. Normally, if you're doing the right thing, you're not going to be targeted for opposition. But suffering for doing good is not to be unexpected. Verse 14, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will still be blessed. Now, he makes an important observation here, that suffering doesn't inhibit blessing. When I'm suffering in my life, I'm thinking, God, would you take away my suffering and would you give me blessing? He says, that's not how it works. Go back to Matthew chapter 5. We call these the Beatitudes, right? Matthew chapter 5. Jesus is laying out how life works. Blessed are those who mourn. Oh, wait a minute. That's not my definition of blessing. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are pure peacemakers. Blessed are those who... Wait a minute. Verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Verse 11. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice, glad, because great is your reward in heaven, because they've persecuted the prophets before you. Wait a minute. Who do you just compare me to? The prophets? He says, blessing doesn't necessarily mean no suffering. And suffering certainly doesn't mean no blessing. But in my life, I end up in James chapter 1. He says, my brothers, count it all joy when you fall into what? Diverse temptations. Knowing this, that the trial of your faith works patience. And let patience have its perfect work so that you can be complete, wanting or lacking in nothing. Wait a minute. I keep asking God to take this bad thing out of my life. God, take this suffering out of my life. God, take this trial out of my life. And God says, why would I take this trial out of my life when this is what I'm using to make you strong? I remember we had the largest soccer court in the entire group of schools that we competed against. And our coach would always bring us out to the soccer court, out to that soccer field at the end of practice, and he'd make us run killers on a soccer field. It's one thing when you have to do killers in a basketball court, where you run to one line, run back, run to the next line, run back, run all the way across the field, run back. But when you're doing it on a soccer field, it's something different. And when you're doing it on the largest soccer field in the league, you feel, this is unjust. This is just not right, right? We say, coach, can we not do this? He says, we cannot do this. Okay, that's one of our options. But if we don't do this, understand what you don't get. You will be winded like everybody else in our league, but you've got the largest field in our league. Why would we not use this tool to make you stronger rather than weaker? But I'm so junior high-ish in my affections. God, this hurts. Take it away. God says, this hurts. I'm making you stronger. This hurts. This is my tool in your life to bring blessing to you and blessing to others. No, I'm not going to take it away. Because I want my patience to have its perfect work so that you can be perfect and entire and lacking in nothing. I want you to be mature. Suffering doesn't inhibit God's blessing, but rather suffering opens the way for glorifying God through obedience. And so he says in verses 14b and 15, he says, now, even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you'll be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy. And he quotes from Isaiah chapter 8, where the southern kingdom, Judah, is looking at Israel to the north and is looking to Assyria beyond that, and they're threatening Israel. And God says, listen, don't fear what they fear. Don't fear people. Don't think that people are in control of this process right now. Rather, I want you to fear me. I want you to sanctify me as holy. I want you to show them that you're not afraid. The only way you can do that is by seeing me as bigger than them. And so he calls us there in verse 15, in your hearts, honor the Christ the Lord as holy. Well, what does that mean? Edmund Clowney gives this definition of reverencing the Lord. To reverence Christ as Lord means really to believe that Christ, not one's human opponents, are truly in control of my events. That Christ, not the Electoral College, is in control of the destiny of the United States of America. That Christ, not Dr. Fauci, is in control of this coronavirus. That Christ, not your spouse, is in control of this marriage. That Christ, not, and you can fill in the blank and you can fill in whatever role they play in your life. That Christ is in control of absolutely everything, and he's working good in this. That means that Christ is responsible to bring something good out of this. If Christ is actually sovereign in this, then Christ is responsible for what happens in this. And so he calls me to obey. You must obey. And if you obey, you will not bottleneck my blessing. If you obey, you will open up the floodgates so that others can see my glory, so that others can see my goodness, so that others can taste me. We see then that suffering opens a way for glorifying God through witness. Verse 15. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense for anyone who asks a reason, why do you have this crazy hope when everything in life is against you? He says, now you have to be ready to answer them in a certain way. You have to answer them with gentleness. You have to answer them with respect. You have to treat them like people, not problems. You have to show them that some dignity in how you respond. And you have to respond in such a way that it's attractive, not in a mean way. But he says, showing them gentleness and respect and having a good conscience, actually living out what you say you believe, so that when you're slandered, those who revile your good behavior can be put to shame. Not that your goal is to shame them, but the idea is that when they see how God works good in your life, they're like, oh, I was wrong. You were right. You were right all along to follow this one because he was worth it. You ever been out and you're not knowing where you're going? And husbands and wives are up in the front seat. And the husband says, I think we'll go this way. The wife says, I think we should go that way. Husband says, I think we should go this way. You decide, whichever way you go, and you take that way, and it doesn't take you where you should go. What's the other one like? Told you. Should have gone my way. There's a vindication, right? Or, by God's grace, you got lucky, and you actually got to where you were going. Told you. Glad we took my way, not your way. That vindication is the idea. The idea of being put to shame is, when you arrive at your destination, you will not be shamed, but they will be shamed for having taken the wrong road, for having taken the wrong route, for having presumed the wrong presuppositions. He said, one day when you get there, you will not be ashamed that you followed Christ through the valley. I guarantee it. He gives us an example then. Well, verse 17, he says finally that suffering is ultimately determined by God. See what it says there in verse 17? It is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. Is it sometimes God's will for me to suffer? Yep. Because nobody obtains the glory except through the suffering. Okay. But it doesn't mean that every situation he wants me just, okay, how can I make my child suffer? That's not God's goal. But he does call me at certain times in my life when he knows I'm strong enough. He doesn't plan for me to fail. He's okay, he's ready for this suffering. Now let's walk him through this. If that's God's will, it's better when I get at the end that I should suffer for doing right than for me to pull out the plugs and slap back and revile and be as ugly as they are. Because when I get there, I'll find out, well, that wasn't worth it. I gave in too soon. I threw away the opportunity that God gave me. He gives us one example then, in verses 18 through 20 of Christ. And this is where it gets a little bit confusing. He moves us, if we can keep this big picture in mind, he says, we're all moving to a destination, and we're either going to be ashamed that we took the wrong road, or we're going to be satisfied. We're going to be vindicated that we followed through on the right path. And he's going to use Christ as an example. In verse 18, he says, now listen, Christ also suffered. He did it in a one-time way. He suffered for sins. Sins that didn't belong to him. This was an unjust suffering, if you will. He was the righteous one who suffered for the unrighteous. Again, this is unjust. He didn't deserve this. But he did it so that he might bring us to God. Well, what did this look like? The purpose was to bring us to God, just like it's my purpose to bring others to God in my suffering. What does this look like for Jesus? It means, at the end of verse 18, he was put to death in the flesh. Okay. That's pretty big. So that's what I'm called to? It might cost me my life? Well, that wasn't the end of the story. He was made alive in the Spirit. Okay, well, the story's getting better. That's good. That's movement from being put to death in the flesh, being made alive in the Spirit. Now, where else does this go? Down to verse 22. When he was gone up into heaven. Oh, well, this is even better. Put to death in the flesh, raised up in the Spirit, gone up into heaven. Well, it doesn't even end there. And is at the right hand of God. Hey, I like this movement. Okay. Jesus, through suffering, gets life, exalted to heaven, and put in a position of authority so that even angels and demons and powers are all being subjected to him. Okay, this is great. I love this. Jesus, when he gets there, it looked like all the powers of hell were in control. When Jesus is on the cross, there's a scene in the Chronicles of Narnia in the book The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe where Aslan is brought to the stone table and the witch and all her hordes are knocking Aslan over. They're shaving his mane. They're wrapping him up with ropes. She plunges in the knife, and everybody's like, yeah, we're the ones. He's the... And that's kind of the way it was when the powers of hell are watching Jesus Christ suffer and die on the cross. We took him down. The Son of God, we took him down. Jesus says, this isn't the end of the story. Walks out of that tomb, rises up to heaven, sits down at the right hand of God, and says, this is the end of the story. And my friend, you feel it. When people are opposing you, people in positions of authority, they're abusing, they're misusing their authority. And it looks like the powers of hell are all winning, and they're laughing at you in your face and saying, you believing what? You call yourself a Christian? What good is God? You know what? It doesn't feel like blessing God. It just doesn't feel like blessing. But I know this isn't the end of the story. I know this isn't the end of the story. And so he holds up Jesus as an illustration for us, but it's a confusing illustration. Karen Jobes reminds us of something here that I think is worth acknowledging. This passage in 1 Peter is one of the most debated and often written about. From the earliest days of the church, it's been understood in many very different ways. In fact, Erickson calculates 180 different exegetical combinations to explain this passage of Jesus preaching to the spirits in prison. Okay, I like what Edmund Clowney says. Martin Luther writes in his commentary, a wonderful text this is, and a more obscure passage, perhaps, than any other in the New Testament. So that I don't know for certain what Peter means. That's Martin Luther, okay? The guy who knew more languages than I'll ever begin to know. The guy who's smarter than 10 of us put together. So Edmund Clowney says this. His confession still warns us against overconfidence. All right? But the book says something, and we have to try to understand it. I'll offer you an explanation. I hope to do it humbly. But here's what I think is happening here. Let's look at end of verse 18. He was put to death in the flesh, but he was made alive in the spirit. And in this spirit, he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. And then he changes to baptism. That's enough to confuse us right there. What in the world did he just say? Here's what I think is happening. I may be wrong, and probably am, but this seems to answer the questions for me. Jesus suffers in this physical realm. He dies. He's raised with a body that no longer has the life source in the blood, right? The life is in the blood, Leviticus. But his life source is no longer in the blood. In fact, when he rises up and he's talking to his disciples, he says, understand that I am not flesh and blood. He says, I am flesh and what? I am flesh and bone. I am inspirited flesh and bone. My life energy now is not in blood which was shed, but it's in spirit. Okay. So Jesus is conquered in the flesh. He dies. But he's raised up with a new life source, the spirit realm. But it empowers his body. It empowers every part of him. And then in this spirit, he goes and proclaims to the spirits in prison. We don't know exactly what that means, other than spirits in prison. How can spirits be imprisoned other than a place of holding spirits, which seems to be a place where they don't want to be, like death? Probably hell, the grave. Why are they there? Because they formerly did not obey. Now, he goes and preaches to them at a time after their disobedience. Some positions say that this is Jesus preaching through Noah back in the days of ark building. That's not what it says. It says he preaches to them after they formerly disobeyed. What's going on here? Did Jesus go in the grave and then go down to the pit and preach to them and then come back up and rise? Ephesians chapter 4, verse 8, gives us just a little bit of a clue as far as what happens here. Ephesians 4, verse 8, says this. Grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gifts. Therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. Now, the book of Hebrews says that Jesus Christ is our forerunner. He's the one who presses into the promised land before ever anybody else does. Jesus is the first human to enter into God's presence. You understand that, okay? Before that, it seems like there was a place where God, Abraham's bosom, where the saints would go. It was paradise. Jesus told the sufferer on the cross, the thief on the cross, today you will enter paradise with me. But the book of Hebrews makes it pretty clear that Jesus is the first one who penetrates the other side, who enters God's presence as holy humanity. Tozer calls him our man in glory. Jesus breaks the way. And when Jesus breaks into heaven, Ephesians 4 verse 8 says, he ascended on high and he led a host of captives. He brought all those who were in paradise, but not yet in heaven. He brought them with him into heaven. When he goes ascending on high in the flesh, it's proved, especially to that entire world that was devastated in the flood, the whole world judgment is there in the grave. And as they watched Jesus leading Noah and everybody else out, they're saying, man, did we make the wrong choice? They've been vindicated. Jesus writes the end of the story. This illustrates the vindication and the shame that Peter talks about back in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7. He says, listen, your tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, is one day going to be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. your faith will be vindicated. He says in chapter 2, verse 12, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they can see your good works and glorify God on the day of vindication, on the day of visitation. When Jesus comes back and gives you your reward, it's like, wow. He says, I want you to understand, judgment came over the entire world at one point in human history. That was the flood. There's coming another judgment that's going to sweep over all of humanity one day. It's not going to be with water, it's going to be with fire. Are you ready for that day? If you're not clinging to Jesus, you're not ready for that day. If he hasn't saved you, you're not ready for that day. If you're not trusting him, you're not ready for that day. But just like Noah, who preached righteousness, and God was waiting for people to repent. God was working in the days of Noah, but a whole world told him, you're nothing. They sidelined him. But Jesus vindicated the preaching of Noah when they were down to eight. Only eight people in the world got it right. But they got it right, because they clung to the one who could provide salvation and nobody else could. And he says, listen, do you feel like you're in a minority? You're not in the minority that Noah was. Do you feel like nobody's listening? You're going to be vindicated, even as Noah was vindicated when the whole world went to hell in a handbasket. Because Jesus Christ wins and brings them to glory. Now he says, this salvation through water, your baptism is the antitype. It's the real thing that was just a picture of. In Michaela, you were baptized last week. In going down in those waters, you entered into the waters like Jesus entered into the grave. You rose out of that grave, a new life. Not that that did anything for you, but you were picturing what Jesus had done in your life. And you were planting your flag with Jesus. In chapter 3, he says, baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you, not as a removal of dirt from the body. It's not something automatic, but as an appeal or a pledge to God for a good conscience. When you enter into the waters of baptism, there's a question that's being asked. Who do you belong to? Whose story are you a part of? Who are you committed to bringing glory to? I'm his. I'm dead, and everything in my life now belongs to him. And it's a pledge. And there's some different interpretations of that one word, but I think the word pledge is helpful. It's the idea of a contract that's sealed between the believer of God. It's a promising to be his, not perfectly, but by his grace, planting my flag with him and saying, everything now belongs to you. It's what Paul said in the verse that you quoted, Galatians chapter 2, verse 20. The life that I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Are you gonna have a clean conscience by living up to your baptismal vow, planting your flag with him, saying, my life is his from here on out? Well, does that include what he's put in your life today? It should. It should. You see, God is using the suffering in your life to make you a mouthpiece of God's blessing to others. And he's making you a mouthpiece of explaining, this isn't the end of the story. God always works glory through suffering. My friend, you may be struggling with something in your life today, and my guess is that you are. Life isn't quite living up to your expectations. But it's not about life. It's about your life. Will you let your life be about proclaiming the goodness of your God? Because honestly, that's what you're designed to do. You are a holy priesthood. You are a royal nation. You can do this. And God is using just the right tools in your life, not the wrong tools, to bring him glory